most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to Question Reality.
Question Reality.
With Priscilla Leona.
Priscilla Leona.
Only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Question Reality. I'm your host, Priscilla Leona, and we are coming to you live from Los Angeles, California. Our show is broadcast every Sunday from 5 p.m. to 5:50 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Now, if this is your first time tuning in, our show will help you to question your career reality. Now, this show is for you if you were, are, or might be considering a career in the entertainment industry. Our guests will provide advice and resource information on how and what it takes to successfully pursue a career in show business. Now, our guests work in various professions of entertainment, so that means that we will definitely have someone on the show sooner or later from a career that you are interested. If you want to check out our past guests, read their bios, listen to their interview instantly, or download one of the shows, go to the LA Talk Radio website, latalkradio.com, and you click at the link on the top of the website that says Channel 1. Scroll down, look for our graphic of the show, Question Reality, and you click the link. And this takes you directly to our archive page, and that is where you can view the list of all of our past guests. Now, our shows are also available for download on iTunes under the podcast section and also on Stitcher.com. So just type in Question Reality Radio in the search box, and you will find all of our shows from 2008 until today. Now, our guests, we are officially booked until the end of the year and actually into January. Hip, hip, hooray. And if you want to find out about all of the guests that are going to be on the show, you have to go to our official website page, and that's QuestionRealityRadioShow.com. QuestionRealityRadioShow.com. Now, today we have a guest on. His name is Eric Schaefer, and he is a client of the wonderful Stephen Lucen. And I was just so honored that Stephen referred his client to me. I'll tell you a little bit about Eric. Now, he's on IMDb if you want to check him out. His name is Eric Schaefer. Let me spell that for you. E-R-I-C-C-H-A-E-F-F-E-R. And again, go to imdb.com and you can find him. He's a director, a screenwriter, and an actor. And we're so thrilled that he's with us today. Now, a little bit about him. He started out driving a cab in his hometown of New York City for 8 years in his 20s. And then he exploded on the film scene with his debut film called My Life's in Turnaround. And that was about 1994. And it just got rave reviews. So he said, well, hey, let's just do it again. So he had a follow-up movie called If Lucy Fell, and that took off like blockbusters. It was just this romantic, like just a romantic meltdown movie, and it's about this concerned 29-year-old therapist who, after her most romantic encounter, makes a pact with her roommate to jump off the Brooklyn Bridge if she hasn't found love by 30. And that hello, we can hear you in the back. Oh, hi, is this Eric?
Yes, how are you?
Oh, my goodness. Okay, hi. I was, your dad was covering for you. He was ready to go on.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize that we were waiting until you were done with all your fancy conversations.
Yes, actually, I was right in the middle of your bio. I was reading your bio. Eric is coming to us live from, I believe, New York. Is that correct, Eric?
No, we're in Vermont, actually. I'm in the middle of shooting. So please forgive me. I was at the country store getting hummus for my salad because it's
my
crazy.
Goodness. Oh, no, no. I mean, just saying the country store in Vermont just titillates me. That sounds so wonderful. I feel like getting some maple syrup right now and just putting it on pancakes. Oh, Lord. Well, I am in the middle of talking about, we were right at you know, after you drove a cab in your hometown in New York for 8 years in your 20s, that you exploded on the film scene and you had a debut film called My Life's in Turnaround. And apparently that got rave reviews. And then you did a follow-up movie, If Lucy Fell. And I was just reading to the audience what that was about. It sounded so interesting. It was about a 29-year-old New York therapist who, after her most recent romantic meltdown, she made a pact with her male roommate to jump off the Brooklyn Bridge if she hadn't found love by 30. And I thought, oh my God, that's so crazy. But it happens, right? And was that starring Sarah Jessica Parker, Ben Stiller, and Ella McPherson starred along you in the film, who wrote, directed, and produced the hit romantic comedy for TriStar. Is that correct?
Indeed, yeah. And actually, it was, I gave Scarlett Johansson her first sort of big movie as a 10-year-old.
Oh.
In it. It was kind of like, and then Junior from The Sopranos was in it. It was kind of a, I don't want to say a launching pad. The Junior from The Sopranos was in Godfather 2. So Dominic Chianese was an obviously established actor, but Scarlett was in it, as well as those other people, Ben and Elle and Sarah Jessica.
Now that just seems like so long ago, doesn't it? My goodness. But that was your first one, so you must have been. Well, your second one, you must have been very, very excited about it. And then you went on to you went on to do Fall, I believe. Is that correct?
Indeed. Fall. A movie called Fall after If Lucy Fell.
Uh-huh. What was that about?
That was a movie called it was about, I played a cab driver who falls in love with a famous model. And it was very sort of shot in New York and ends in Paris. And it was a very, very romantic, some people think, I certainly agree, film. A little darker than the first two, sort of a love story between a cab driver and a married model.
Mm-hmm.
And then I actually made, just last year, I decided to make a sequel to that film called After Fall Winter, shot in Paris, which was about the same, the character I played 15 years later.
Oh, my God.
And I sort of have an idea to do a series, you know, fall, winter, spring, summer, every 15 years, depicting the sort of lifelong challenge that this character has to find love in his life. So
oh.
The first one was in 97, and the next one was in 2013, God willing. You know, I'm alive and still can make movies. In 15 years, we would do the next installment, and then in 30 years, we would do the next one.
That is the most interesting thing. I never even heard of that. That's like back in the 80s where they did those commercials where it was like a little mini story, and it continued and you had to wait. It was like a little soap opera and you had to wait till the next commercial to see, was the person going to drink Maxwell House? I have never heard of anyone doing that before, but I have often talked to my husband about that. Why don't they do that? Like with your favorite films, why can't we just take it as the characters are going through life? That would be a great concept, and you're actually doing it.
A couple of people have done it. Richard Linklater did it with his sort of Before Sunrise, After Sunset. I'm sorry, I'm getting the titles wrong because I'm a dyslexic, but before it was Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke. So there's been three in that series, and then there was a man and a woman, a famous French film, and then a man and a woman 20 years later. So there have been a couple people that have done it, but then Michael Apted in the documentary world had a very famous series called 7 Up, 14 Up, 21 Up, 28 Up, which followed these kids at 7 all the way, I think, up to 35 or 42. But that was a documentary. So a couple of people have done it, but I don't think anyone, to my knowledge, other than a man and a woman 20 years later, to such a degree that I have and hopefully will do over spanning sort of 45 years of a man's life.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't heard of those other films, unfortunately. Now I'm going to have to look them up, but I just love the concept so much. Let's start back, because I really like to start with this very, very basic question of everyone, because people like to know what you aspire to do in the inception of your life and then what you ended up doing. So when you were little, what did you see yourself being?
Well, I wanted to be the Beatles. You know, I mean, I grew up, I was born in 1962, so I wanted to be a rock star and follow in the Beatles' footsteps, and I wanted to be a pro basketball player. So those two things were my true passion was to be a gas station attendant and pump gas or work the hand elevator, the back service elevator. Because as a kid, those were the most exciting. I had an Uncle Cy who pumped gas, and I just thought that was the coolest thing. and then working with, you know, the brass handle on the elevator operator elevator, you know, when you operate the elevator, yeah, with the hand thing.
Yeah.
That seems so cool to me too. So once in a while, the doorman would let me run that thing. So other than that, though, then it elevated to rock star or pro basketball player, and I actually, those two passions I really did work hard towards and learned how to play instruments and played a lot of basketball and got invited to a very prestigious camp called Five Star Camp when I was a junior in high school, and didn't end up going that way. But those were sort of up through high school. Those were my two passions, were music and basketball.
Okay. And when you got out of, say, high school, did you by that time know that there might be a little flickering of getting into the film business, because you're almost close to your 20s now, or did you go right into driving a cab and you didn't know?
No, in high school, besides music and basketball, I was writing plays and acting a lot. So high school, I definitely wanted to be an actor. And then in college, when basketball wasn't happening and I decided not to sort of continue music, acting took over. So I was acting and dancing in college, actually, and writing plays.
Wow.
So I knew it hadn't formed, and I always loved movies. And as a kid, I would make little Super 8 movies. So I just sort of, it was a bit amorphous, but I knew it was going to be acting and directing film and plays. And then as my senior year in college, a very famous director named Arthur Penn came, because his daughter Molly was at Bard, and he taught a guest screenwriting class. And Arthur Penn directed Bonnie and Clyde, and among other, that was one of his most famous films. So I wrote my first screenplay, and then I got out of college and immediately started driving a cab to make money and started writing, because I figured that, you know, wanting to write, direct, and act, writing was the easiest way to sort of have the most control, because as an actor or a director, you need someone to give you a job. Mm-hmm. But as a writer, I figured you could try to get a movie made that you wrote, and you'd have the most control, so I could have some sort of a tethering between my work and my dream, and not just sort of be spinning my wheels. So then I wrote for 10 years in the cab. I drove 50 hours a week in the cab and wrote for 50 hours a week not in the cab, and all through my 20s.
Wow. Now, as a cab driver, did you find any funny stories or have any surprising moments that kind of led to you wanting to write a story? And whether you did or you didn't, it was something that you remember specifically?
It's funny. It's a question that leaps out when you drive a cab, because, you know, you'd think that there would be. And quite honestly, I drove a cab full-time for 8 years, and there weren't that many bizarre things that happened. It was mainly just this beautiful chance to witness life in New York City, which I love, and it's my hometown, you know, 12 hours a day. But there actually weren't that many, you know, a handful of strange occurrences in the cab, which I did end up putting in the movie, in various movies. But there were really only a few. It was really pretty mundane in terms of bizarrity, but not in terms of being able to sort of, again.
Wow. Now, that's totally different from Cash Cab that we see running around New York City. I don't know if you've seen that show, but there was.
Yeah, all those kind of taxi cab confessions. I mean, I'm here to tell you that they have to run a lot of footage to get those stories. Like, trust me, they're rolling for 12 hours, and then they're picking out maybe one a day if they're lucky.
Wow. I thought that was an interesting concept. I love that concept for Cash Cab. That was great. You got to see the inside on what New Yorkers were really like and some other people. Now, when you decided that you were going to start making movies, now, some people are fortunate to have gone through college, have a job, or they have saved money and they have money for their first film. Because the premise of the show is to give tips, advice, and resource information on how and what it takes to pursue a career in entertainment, I'm going to ask you questions that would help the audience. Let's focus on primarily beginning filmmakers. So what are your suggestions, even though it's today rather than when you got started, but maybe the principles are still the same. What do you feel are three or more, five characteristic traits that it takes in order to really say, you know what, I'm going to be a filmmaker. I know I might be poor. I know it's going to be a struggle, but I'm going to do it. What do you feel the characteristic traits are, so you know if you choose it, you've got the right stuff, the basic backbone?
Well, it's interesting. It's a good question, because there actually are characteristics, I think, personality-wise, that go the farthest in making a possibility of success. And because now, these days, it's financially, it's so much easier to make a film because, you know, the people literally are shooting films on their phones, you know. And so when I started making movies, 16 millimeters still cost you, you know, tens of thousands, if not $100,000, $200,000 to make a movie. Forget 35 millimeter, that was $500,000 sort of at least. But now you can make a completely, you know, legitimate film in terms of the marketplace, in terms of people watching it, for next to nothing. So the financial sort of ramifications, it's not holding you back. So then it just becomes that you have the ability to have an attitude of, I'm going to do this at all costs, no matter what. I'm just going to make it happen. And I learned, a guy told me in my beginning of my career, he said, you pick a start date and you don't move off it. And your best friend will come to you, your girlfriend will come to you and explain, tell you why you must move off this date. You can get more money if you wait. There's an actor you can get if you wait. And you do not move off that date. And those were the sagest words I was ever given. And so I'm shooting my film now called Boy Meets Girl in Vermont. It's my ninth feature film. I made 100 episodes of television in the last 20 years. And I always do that. I pick a start date and I don't move. And whoever shows up to help me, we make the movie. Whatever money I have, we make the movie. And we,
wow,
kind of like that asking you shall receive, and the universe conspires to help you succeed, if you put the ball in motion. So the first characteristic would be, you know, an attitude, mm-hmm, of never say die, and then I'm just going to make this happen. And then that's really independent-wise, depending on the kind of movie you want to make. If you want to make an action movie or an alien movie or a sci-fi movie and stuff that costs millions of dollars, then that's different. But if you're making a movie that is a sort of a more of a talking movie or a, you know, funny or romantic movie that doesn't have a lot of sort of special effects and cars in it, then you set yourself up to succeed in that way. So really, the number one characteristic would be just that you have an attitude that you're going to make it happen no matter what.
Got it. And what
those
about...
Those are the first five. Like five characteristics. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Okay.
Literally.
Okay. Right. Yeah. All incorporated and rolled in there. Oh, my gosh. Well, something you had said, if you have a phone today, you can make a movie. Now, as you know, people want to get recognition. And yes, you can use a phone to make a movie, and that's great. But when you go to enter it into film festivals, which is how you need to get your film acknowledged to a certain extent, they have a lot of requirements. You know, you've got to have money to put it on like a master. It's got to be this quality, da, 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 da. What do people do if they don't have the money to shoot it on, say, a Mysterium camera or any other camera? What do they do if they don't have the money to do that and they don't want to shoot it on their phone because it's not going to be good enough to enter into a film festival?
Well, I mean, but literally, you know, I mean, there was that, I think, Waiting for Sugarman or Finding Sugar, Looking for Sugarman, that I might be wrong, I might be being mixed up, but there was like a big documentary that was shot, I think it was that movie, Looking for Sugarman, that was literally shot on his iPhone, if I'm not wrong, at least a big chunk of it. And so, mm-hmm, you know, everyone, you can find a camera. I mean, you can put ads on various websites asking for crew members, people that want to help make a movie. You find friends, you talk to friends, does anyone have a camera? I mean, so many people own their own cameras now, which don't have to be a Red or an expensive Canon, but quite honestly, a lot of people do have those cameras, and they're dying to make movies. So you can find people that would work for free, you know, or you feed them, or you don't need a big crew. You need 5 or 6 people, a sound guy, a guy with a camera, you know, and you just go out, you do it. So you really don't need a lot of money. I mean, mm-hmm, having said that, you know, it's still, you got to feed people. I mean,
yeah,
so it's a couple $1,000 to feed people. You know, if you shoot for 10 days,
mm-hmm,
shoot for 6 or 7 days and you have 5 people, you know, just do the math. I mean, so you have to have a few $1,000s. But if you make the movie in your house, you know, pay for the location, you get a camera, you get people that'll, you know, your mom's making bowls of chili every night. I mean, you can really do it,
mm-hmm,
depending on the kind of movie you want to make.
So now, so you feel that, even if you're in LA or New York, that you could still do this.
Yeah,
you
sure.
Still do this. Okay.
Again, it really depends on the kind of script you want to shoot. You obviously can't do it if it's a movie that requires a lot more going on in terms of effects or action or bus scenes on a, you know, with big ocean liners, you know, of course, or planes flying, you know. But if it's a kind of film that can be shot where people are talking in a house, walking on the street, I mean, it's even in New York City, it costs $300 to get film permits for your whole shoot. So you have basically, you can walk through Times Square and shoot your movie just like a Dustin Hoffman film does for $300 as long as you get a permit.
It's not that way out in L.A. Maybe we need to talk about L.A. You need to give some people in L.A. some tips, because, my God, you can spend a fortune on your film permits. It's very – it's probably, you know, much different. I'm not an expert, but it's probably much different to shoot in New York than it is here. But I swear to God, it is so expensive. I cannot tell you how expensive it is. Have you shot in L.A., and can you give any tips to people who could shoot here for an inexpensive price?
I never have shot in L.A., but I don't know how much – I don't know how much permits are, but I don't suspect that – it sounds like you know better than I, but, you know, other than that, it's still the same thing.
Nobody wants to work for free. I'm from the East Coast. I'm from Connecticut. So yeah. I can tell you right now, yes, you can get a ton of people to help your little butt when you're in Connecticut and in New York and D.C. and Baltimore and Philly. I mean, it's just a different world, Eric. It really is. People want to help each other out here. I hate to say it, but honestly, it is like pulling teeth to get people to volunteer to help and do anything. I mean, you can find them, but then you're going to get people who really just don't want to be there. And they're not going to have a smile on their face and really feel like they want to do it. They just want the credit for IMDb. So it is really hard to get people out here to do things for free. You got to really pay them. And I personally feel like you should pay. If you're going to do something, I just can't personally have people working for me and not pay them something. And then out here, it's so hard to get a film permit. And then when you try to get a house, it's like minimum $1,500 to $2,000 a day to shoot, you know, in one room. And then you got to get insurance in case, you know, something happens to the house. And I mean, by the time you finish paying for all of the insurance company and the permits and this, you're lucky if you have any money to shoot a film for like $2,000-$3,000, $5,000 if you're lucky. So people out here keep asking me, what can you do? And I say, well, it's just that's why our business is going to Canada and Iceland and New Zealand and Costa Rica and Malta, because they offer such wonderful perks. I mean, out here they gouge you to death in LA. So I know you probably don't have any advice because you haven't shot out here, but any tips for people to make a film out here and knowing what I just told you?
Well, again, yeah. I mean, like, there's plenty of people. Everyone has friends, so your friends aren't going to charge you $1,500 to shoot in their house for a day. So you find your friends. You just network your people, especially now with social networking and all that stuff. You know, I mean, I'm on Twitter.
I'm on
Facebook, so people can always contact me there, you know. And, like, Boy Meets Girl is on. I did an Indiegogo campaign that ended, but... So, like, there's ways to do it through social media and just your friends, you know, and the local shop you always go to. You just ask. And if you're nice, say, hey, can I shoot in your – I need a pizza or shoot a scene for it. Like, do you have a day off? Are you ever closed? They're like, yeah, we're closed Mondays. You know, I'm like, oh, yeah, sure, come in there.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm telling you, L.A.
I'm trying to shoot a scene for NBC on a Saturday, and I call restaurants, and the first thing they say is, how much are you going to pay me? Like 25. Yeah. How much? So it's kind of hard. It's kind of harder out here, but where there's a will, there's a way. If you want to do it, then I guess you'll find a way.
Exactly.
Now let's talk about, you briefly mentioned Kickstarter and Indiegogo. Now, I don't know if you're aware of this, but it's just crazy to me because I can see both sides of this thing, but it's almost like there's a coup d'etat happening here, because Indiegogo and Kickstarter started out as a way for people who didn't have money to fund their films, right? So now people are getting upset. Not me. I could not care less because I have a different perspective on it. But a lot of people are getting very upset because now you have celebrities coming in and wanting to get their stuff made. And the general feeling amongst independent filmmakers and people just trying to get a project done is, why are they coming in and onto our territory when they could fund these things themselves? You know, you got Zach Braff, who has a campaign, and then you have Shamar Moore from Criminal Minds. And these are, you have these famous people coming in and they want to make their film projects. And they're, I understand their perspective, because when the studios get hold of their stuff, I mean, it completely, it just changes. They take it, they take control, et cetera, et cetera. So they want to maintain that control, and that's why they want to do it. But the filmmakers, the independent little guy feels that they're encroaching on the territory and they're going to take all the money. I look at it as, you know, Shamar Moore, Zach Braff, the celebrities, they have their fan base, and if people want to give to them, they're going to give to them. If they want to give to you, they're going to give to you. It just really depends on the project and if they like it or not. What is your feeling on this?
Well, I have no problem with it. It's like, listen, if people are getting things for it. They're getting a T-shirt, they're getting whatever, and they feel like they're part of helping someone they really like make a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So,
There's lots of perks. Yeah, I mean, if you're a Shamar Moore fan and he's going to give a perk of an autographed picture, then give to his movie.
They're not twisting anybody's arm. So it's like, God bless them. If someone, if you don't want to give to them, don't give to them. I mean,
you heard that from Eric. If you don't want to give, don't give. But, you know, let's not be striking and go into the White House.
People don't understand also. It's not so easy. Just Zach Braff is a big star, but it's just not easy to run around and say, I'm Zach Braff, give me $3 million to make my movie.
Yeah.
It's just not. Anymore. Those days are over, even for him. You know, there's no video anymore that they can count on to get back to $3 million. They're not going to open it necessarily theatrically. I mean, it's not an easy landscape even for people that have a face and name recognition like Zach Braff.
Absolutely.
And people don't understand that. So they just think that, oh, you're a big star. People think of me. Some people gave me a hard time, like, for doing mine. I'm like, are you kidding me? It's like, you know, independent filmmaking. So who cares? If you don't want to give them, don't give them any money. But it's not like people are, you know, they're happy to help and they want to help be part of it.
Yeah,
I'm having an awesome time talking. I shoot in 12 hours, though.
What?
In 12 hours from now, I shoot. I have to go to bed. I have day 7 of the film I'm making right now at 8:30 tomorrow morning.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. Well, our interview is over at 5:50. So,
time 5:50?
Yeah, it's 5. Oh, I'm LA time, so it's 5:28 here. 5:28. So we actually go until 5:50, which would be 5:50. I don't know what that is your time. Didn't Stephen tell you any of this?
No, I didn't know that we were going to talk. I didn't know we were going to talk for an hour. I guess.
I'm sorry about that. He called me and said that you wanted to be on the show, and I just assumed that he told you it was a 50-minute show and that we'd be talking about premise of the show is to help people to to get ideas of how to make films and give tips, advice, and resource information. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah,
and
no, it's awesome.
You can hang on for just 20 more minutes and help the people. God, we'd really, really appreciate it. So as far as Kickstarter and Indiegogo, I certainly understand what you're saying. Not everybody is going to have a successful campaign. Melissa Joan Hart, who was from Sabrina the Teenage Witch, my God, the woman, unfortunately, and I love her, her campaign failed miserably, and she was interviewed in the Huffington Post, and she said that the main reason that it failed was because her team they just assumed if they put it up on Indiegogo or Kickstarter, can't remember, I think it was Kickstarter, that people were going to just donate because it was Melissa Joan Hart. And she said, now I would do it differently. And what I would do is, I understand that social media is so very important. You've got to have a team constantly working on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, and promoting constantly. And you've got to have perks. Perks are so important. So that, to me, is I completely agree that that is the essence of what you're going to have to do to get the job done and to meet your goal for Kickstarter. As a matter of fact, I'm associate producer on a feature film right now with Dean Cain and Eric Roberts and Sally Kirkland, and it's called A Horse for Summer. And we've already met our first wave and then of funds on Kickstarter because of the perks we offered. I mean, I have an office in Paramount Studios, and I and she does as well. And some of the perks that we're offering is that we'll, if you donate a certain amount, and this is a tip for people out there, we're offering if you donate a certain amount that you can come on the lot, and we'll take you on the lot for lunch, and then we'll give you a tour of Paramount Studios, our office, as well as we're in Lucy Bungalow 101. So we're right in the bungalow where Lucille Ball was, and you walk 25 feet, there's stage 25. So that's something that we can offer that people are like, oh my God, I would die to get on the lot of Paramount. People would come worldwide. So these are the sort of things that you need to offer. Think about, do you have any friends that work at studios? Do you have any kind of situation like Dean Cain? We're working it in where if you know somebody that has t-shirts or products, we're saying Dean Cain will wear them, and what better than the old Superman wearing your product? So you just have to be creative. That's where you're going to get the money. And that's my tip for Kickstarter offering the perks. Do you agree?
Well, yeah. I mean, people talk about those perks a lot. I mean, for me, I guess it's certainly the perks are one thing, but I feel like people give because they just want to be part of it. You know. And so if you have cool perks like that, I think that it's great. But I guess I'm of a mind that if mm-hmm. I'm going to give, I'm going to give because I want to be part of
because
it.
Because you like it. Yeah.
The t-shirt isn't really the draw, but
yeah.
You know, and you know, I offer things like, you know, posters and t-shirts, and if at a certain price, we could go to dinner.
This would be like getting corporate sponsors. Like we would say, like we're going to say to companies that we would wear, like, for example, if you're a tennis guy and you wear Nike t-shoes, so their t-shirts will be shown in the film worn by the stars. That, I mean, companies are going to definitely want to get sponsorship and get their products, product placement.
Yeah. On my Indiegogo, I mean, you know, for Boy Meets Girl, we didn't meet our total goal. You know, I tried to get 95 grand, but we raised like 20% of that, which was great. And we gave, you know, all kinds of cool perks, and we might do a follow-up campaign to help raise sort of finishing funds. But mm-hmm. But again, even on my Facebook and Twitter, you know, people were really supportive. And again, if you get a sort of a part of the money that you get from there, and then you can just sort of cobble it together from other people, that's the way to make it.
Now, you're familiar with Kickstarter and Indiegogo. Which one do you prefer, if any, and what is your reasoning why you feel you would recommend one over the other? Well, I have my reasoning. What's your reason?
The only reason I did Indiegogo is because I wanted to keep – they let you keep all the money regardless of if you meet your goal, where Kickstarter doesn't – all the money goes away if you don't meet
right.
your goal. So that was the only
right.
reason.
I know. I don't really understand, honestly, why people wouldn't go with Indiegogo, because you get the money right away. I mean, it's going right into your pocket, honeys. Whereas Kickstarter, I guess it was the first one. It's more, I'm just going to put air quotes on this, more reputable or more well-known.
Right.
But mm-hmm. I love Indiegogo, and I think that's the way to go, especially if you need startup development funds. Now, let's talk about what are you doing now? What films are you working on? What are the expectations that you have? What's going to happen with them? Let's talk about your current films.
Well, I'm shooting a movie. My new movie is called Boy Meets Girl, and it's a very like all my films, it's a very honest, raw, funny romantic comedy about three 21-year-olds, one girl who's a genetic girl, and one boy who's a genetic boy, and then one girl who's a transgender girl. So it's a story about a girl that grew up in the South who's completely passable as a transgender girl and sort of from 7 years old was living in the world as a girl. And her best friend is this kind of straight football playing, funny, nice guy, and they were just pals their whole life, and we meet them in the story at 21, and they're just buddies. And she laments that she's having a hard time finding, you know, a guy that wants more than just sex, and that it's easy for guys to hit on her because she's so beautiful, but that, you know, when it gets to the point, she's pre-op, so she hasn't gotten the full operation yet, so she still has woman and taking hormones to grow breasts. And so she decides that she might try a girl, and maybe she'd find some love and compassion and more than just someone wanting to get in her pants. So she in walks this sort of debutante, and who's waiting for her Marine boyfriend to come home from the war to get married, and they strike up an affair. So it's kind of a love triangle between this sort of, her life's all laid out for her debutante, who never would have ever considered, you know, cheating on her boyfriend, let alone with a transgender girl. And the transgender girl, Ricky, and then her best friend, Robbie, who's a straight boy. So it's a romantic comedy that's very sweet and touching and funny and certainly erotic and edgy, but it's not angsty. You know, it's not so many films in the gay, lesbian, and, you know, transgender community, brilliant films, but like Monster or Boys Don't Cry, often, you know, they're very violent, or they're about serial killers or people getting harmed. And there are not as many movies like, there certainly are, The Adventures of Two Girls in Love and Kissing Jessica Stein, and the movies are out there, but there's not as many of them. So I thought it'd be really cool to make a movie that was very romantic and sweet and fun and funny and sexy that happened to have a transgender girl in it. So I'm shooting that now, and it's going fantastically well. And
is that the one you're shooting in Paris?
No, I shot that in Paris. That came out. That was called After Fall Winter.
Okay.
That came out last January.
Okay.
And so that's on iTunes and sort of Amazon and all the places people can get digital movies, Netflix.
Okay.
Showtime. But no, I'm shooting Boy Meets Girl now in Vermont, and we finished the first week last week, and today was our quote unquote day off, which is not a day off for me. It's just getting everything together and getting ready for tomorrow morning. And then
now, do you have, are you known for a certain genre of film? I mean, do you do mostly romantics? Do you do like, oh, I feel like doing maybe a sci-fi this year? No, next year I feel like doing, or do you like the genre of the romantics, the rom-coms?
If I've sort of carved out any kind of milieu or theme to my eight, now nine films and all my television work as well, I guess it would be that it's all romantic in nature. It's all mostly pretty funny, but also very human and dark at times, sort of celebrating humanity in all of its nature, you know, from the funny to the sublime to the tragic.
Hello? 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 Okay. Oh my goodness, I think we lost him and we're trying to get him back. Let's see if that's happening. Boy, this is a first. There's always a first. Hello. We kind of lost you right at Sublime.
Oh, well, so from Sublime to, you know, that basically the turns of humanity that we know living in the real life go from sublime to tragic in a moment. You know, we're having a wonderful moment, and then we turn the corner and something tragic can happen, or those are the extremes, not quite those extremes. So the film celebrates humanity and the things that most of us think about, but that often we don't talk about or discuss or even admit to ourselves. So
now when you finish your film, this particular one, we'll just talk about this one. Do you already have distribution set up? Do you work with anyone? Tell us, for people who don't know what happens, just briefly, after you finish your film, I don't know if you have distribution, you probably do, but tell us what happens for the beginning filmmaker, what they need to do after they finish their little movie. What should be their steps?
Well, I mean, you know, you go to festivals, and I don't have distribution yet, and one would go take their movie and submit it to festivals. And there's only two or three festivals that are really meaningful in terms of selling your movie, which are Sundance, Toronto, and Cannes. There's some other bigger festivals that are helpful to get press out of, but really to make a sale at a festival, those are the three. So you submit to festivals and you start to garner some press when you go to those festivals. That's the first sort of order of business. If you don't get a distributor out of those festivals or someone approaching you, then you approach distributors and you just cold call every distributor that's out there and you say, hey, I have a film. Can you watch it? Can I send it to you? And most of them will say yes. and you send them the film, or you try to set up a screening for them, which I like to do better, but they'll try to say, just send us a DVD or a download. And I say, no, please come watch it, and maybe you'll get them to a screening. You do kind of a screening for family and friends and invite distributors, because it's always better to see it big in a theater. But if they won't come, then you give it to them, and they watch it, and then sort of hopefully you'll get a nibble from them. So that's sort of the avenue.
What happens if a person is not fortunate enough to have their film selected by a film festival? Now, we can't say that just because their film was not selected that it's not a great film, because, and you would know probably better than I, but I have heard through the grapevine that the big tier, the A-tier festivals like Cannes and Sundance, I have heard that pretty much they know who they're going to put in, and they've selected most of the slots, and they leave a couple open, but they pretty much give it to well-known celebrities. They have preferences, and this is just what I heard. I can't confirm nor deny, but I've heard it so much that it may possibly ring true with me. I've even had purple people who work at festivals say, you know what, Priscilla, it's go B tier or C tier to start out. But so do you feel that that's true, that most of the films are already selected for the A tier film festivals like Cannes and Sundance and all of those, and that it's a long shot and that you should probably start out maybe with like a B or C tier film festival, like your local?
Well, I think it's hard to get in those. I mean, they definitely have thousands and thousands and thousands of films to go through, you know, and they have a very finite amount of spots. So.
And if you have money, if you have a small budget, because it costs money to enter into film festivals, for people who don't know that, if you haven't made a film yet, it costs money every time you submit to a film festival. You know, where is the bulk of the budget? What should you be thinking about as a first-time filmmaker if you don't have that much money? Should you spend all your money on the A tier, or kind of do a mix, or just go C tier?
Well, I mean, I think it's $100 or $75 to most of the big festivals, and so there's only three or four sort of A-list tiers. It's Sundance, Cannes, Toronto. That's pretty much it. I mean, there's South by Southwest is right up there, and Berlin, and you know, you have
Tribeca. I think we said Tribeca.
Yeah, you know, big? And yeah. Buddy Ride. But you're gonna have to spend. I mean, I always take my shot. I mean, I make a film and I always think it's going to blow up. So I think I'm going
to. So you have to have that mentality. You got to at least try.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And what happens if they don't get in the big ones? Do they just put it on the shelf and move on to their next film? Or do you recommend that they shop it around, try other B, C, I hate to say A, B, and C, but that's what they call them, more B tier and local film festivals to at least try that? Or should they move on to their next project?
Well, no, I mean, to me, a film is an extremely passionate endeavor. It's like a child. It's not, that would be saying, like, do I abandon my child off on the street?
But they do. They do. People out here. Yeah, people out here.
I would never do that. I mean, what I would do is.
Me neither. I would shop it until it had dusty cobwebs on it. But, yeah. So
what I do is that I at any cost, when I haven't gotten my movies distributed, I rented theaters and put my movies in theaters. And now you can have a website, and you can go through social media and tell everyone you have a website and sell it off your website. So, I mean, now there's more ways than ever to get your films out.
Absolutely. There's a wonderful website called pivotshare.com. And this website is just awesome because you can put your film in it, and they have like the back software where they calculate, you can sell it, you can rent it, you can rent it, you can sell it, you can do all kinds of stuff, and it calculates and keeps all of the accounting right there on the website. And you can either sell a subscription, a monthly subscription, if you have a lot of films, or you can just do a pay per person watching it. And what's great is that you have all of that accounting that's done for you behind the scenes for your, at the end of the year, for your taxes. So I just love it personally. And then there's Hulu. You can put it on Hulu, Mubi, M-U-B-I. You can do it on YouTube. There's so many different things, right, Eric?
Yeah, well, that's that. Yeah, I mean, back in the day when I started, there was, you know, you had six, you know, you had like 10 distributors, and if they didn't pick it up, you were done. You know, you can try to get a DVD deal, but now, you know, there are a lot of places that, like the, all the ones you just mentioned, that you can try to get your film out. So, you know, now more than ever, you have other sort of ancillary.
So you at least will be generating some income, even if it's just a buck. It's better than nothing. You'll get some money back, but if you feel like you've drained everything out of it that you can, and you feel like moving on, it's okay. You can let go and move on to your next project. You don't have to feel like you are abandoning your little child, because you really are taking care of it, because it's going to be generating funds on these other websites. It's still being taken care of, right? It's still being looked after.
Yeah. As long as you put it somewhere where people can see it, even if it's your website, and just sell it for, you know, $3 or $6 off your website, or find a way to. There are a lot of companies now that will offer you, take a percentage of every download and put it on their sort of websites, and you can, where people go that are destination websites for people to go watch movies, and it's a one-stop shopping place. So you can investigate those on Google.
Absolutely. I mean, don't give up. Just try it. Now, we only have 3 minutes to go, and I'm going to ask you these two questions, and we'll wrap it up. What is the worst piece of advice you've ever gotten when you've asked someone about how can I become a filmmaker, or what should I do to become a filmmaker? The worst advice, and then I'm going to ask you the best advice.
Wow, it's funny. I don't think I ever ask anyone for advice.
What have you heard? What have you heard somebody give another person?
Do it. I mean, I'm so dismissive of naysayers and negative people.
Yeah. So something you want to avoid. If somebody tells you to do this, avoid it at all costs.
Yeah, the basic thing is anyone's ever told me, you know, you can't do that. I mean, that's the worst advice I've ever, and the best advice. It's funny, the question is, you know, I once had an acting teacher that said, you know, tell the worst story that you've in your life, and then now tell it as the best story. And it's kind of the same point. It's like, it's the worst and best advice, because, and I had an acting teacher too in college who would say, you know, love, you're terrible. Just, you're terrible. Please get out of the business. I'm going to save you a lot of heartache. You know, these are the 18-year-old kids. But it's actually great, because you either said, you know, forget you, I'm going to do it anyway, or you got out of the business. And if you did, you didn't have the spine or the skin it takes. Doesn't make you a bad person, but this business is extremely rough if you don't have a really solid, outrageous sense of self and motivation. So the worst advice would be, you know, you can't do this, you should wait. That's the worst advice, and it's also the best advice, because if you when you hear that, you go, great, thank you, I'm not going to listen to that, and that's going to motivate me to go do it right now. So the best advice I told you, which was pick a start date, don't move off it. That was the best advice I ever got. Mm. Pick a date and do not move off it. And whatever you get, and I literally, if people fall away the day before, you lose a location, the guy with the camera says on my shoot, one of my guys got a spider bite. And I lost him for a day in the hospital. This was yesterday. You know what I mean? One of my camera guys. So like, hey, you're going to be okay? Yeah. Okay. He'll be back tomorrow. Like, you just make it happen.
Wow. Oh, my God. I feel so bad, because those spider bites can hurt. I've had that before. Okay, so Boy Meets Girl, transgender romantic comedy starring Michelle Henley and Twilight star Michael Welch. We did not talk about that. We're going to have a Twilight star in there, so that must be exciting. When can we expect, as an audience, to hopefully be able to see it in theaters?
Hey, I'm sorry. I'm in rickety old Vermont, where, you know, even landlines seem to just chop off.
I said Boy Meets Girl. It's a transgender romantic comedy starring transgender lead Michelle Henley?
Henley. Yeah,
and Twilight star Michael Welch. What did Michael Welch do in Twilight?
He was a kid who takes Kristen Stewart to the movies in one scene and one.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, he's an unbelievably talented actor. Michelle is the first movie. She's great. And then Alexandra Tershin, who's playing the debutante, is amazingly good. And this is one of her first big films. So,
Brother.
The cast is amazing, yeah.
Wow. So you have a large amount of pre-production press included on the top gay sites and the TMZ sister site, which is toofab.com, T-O-O-fab.com. So everybody who wants to check out Eric's film, you can – oh, do you have a website for it as well? Do you have
Not yet. I just have – you know, I'm very active on Facebook and Twitter.
Okay.
And so there's a lot of info on the Indiegogo Boy Meets Girl site, too, even though the campaign's over. There's still a video up there with Michelle and me, and so people can poke around there, and it's a lot of fun.
Okay, so you can find Eric Schaefer on imdb.com. Just type in his name, Eric Schaefer. You can also find information about the movie on toofab, T-O-O-F-A-B.com, and also go to Indiegogo and type in Boy Meets Girl, and you should be able to find information about it. I mean, my goodness, you might want to put up another wave of financial requests and get some more money.
Yeah, we got it. We got enough to get it in the can and hopefully to edit. But thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you. You gave a lot of great information to the audience, and hopefully Eric has inspired you today to go out and make your own film. So say goodbye to your fans, Eric Schaefer.
Well, thank you all for having me, and I appreciate more than anything that people all the kind words people send me about my films, and of course without them watching it, that's the goal. That's the goal, is to stand in a theater and watch people watch the film.
That's the exciting thing. Well, make sure you tell us when the film comes out so we can advertise it. Okay.
You'll be my first, and I will make sure I budget the, because it's so funny, because I love nothing more than talking for 15 minutes. And had I been aware of it, I would have settled down with my little salad, so I wouldn't have dropped my blood sugar. But
I am so sorry. I'm going to send an email to that Steven
No, he's so great, and I'm sure he told me. And in my haste, I've just probably so unused.
I know, because he's very detail oriented and
he's great.
Professional.
He's fantastic, and I'm sure that I was just probably because I'm so used to people wanting 3 minutes that when he said 50, it probably read it as 5 or something.
Yeah, blocked it out. You had a mental block.
Please forgive me. Please forgive me.
That's fine.
Trying to bail. It wasn't because I wasn't having fun. Every shot that I'm doing tomorrow morning.
No, I understand. My God, because you're on the East Coast, so it's 3 hours difference. You got to get up very early to be on the set. Thank you for sharing
your
time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. Thank you, listeners. We'll see you next week on The Question Reality. Bye.
Okay, bye. Bye.
You're listening to Question Reality. Question Reality. With Priscilla Leona. Only on LA Talk Radio.